Open your books to Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8. Everybody, today's class in the economics of constitutional law is now in session. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 22nd of November. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. I am not going too far out on a limb here. In fact, I'm not going out on it at all to say that the Trump presidency is going to present some challenges. Politically, for sure. Economically, definitely. And constitutionally, perhaps. We begin today with what is known as the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution of the United States, and how it might pertain to a certain billionaire businessman turned president-elect. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
You may remember the Foreign Emoluments Clause from Never. It has rarely ever come up. It says,
if you hold an office under the United States, you can't take a gift or anything of value from foreign powers.
Zephyr Teachout teaches law at Fordham. The idea was to prevent meddling by foreign powers. Some scholars argue it doesn't apply to the president, but presidents from Van Buren to Obama have certainly acted as if it does.
Presidents have taken this extremely seriously.
Oh, yes. We had quite a few people presenting gifts to the president, and many of them were turned down.
Richard Painter was chief ethics counsel to George W. Bush.
So I remember somebody from Saudi Arabia trying to give the national security advisor a Rolex watch. We decided that that was not too good an idea.
Now, the Emoluments Clause and similar statutes covering bribes and foreign gifts don't bar the president from engaging in a run-of-the-mill business deal. The problem is that every private business deal with a foreign entity has the potential to curry favor and influence, for example, through overpayment or greasing regulatory wheels. Fordham University's Zephyr Teachout again.
Since we don't actually have a window into those transactions, we wouldn't know.
The Trump Organization has ongoing deals around the world, from golf courses in Scotland to real estate deals in Argentina. A government wanting to curry favor has lots of targets to choose from. Lawrence Tribe is professor of constitutional law at Harvard.
That's why no president in the history of this country has maintained ongoing economic interests in other countries.
Donald Trump has 2 months to figure it out. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
It's been an interesting 24 hours in the life cycle of the relationship between President-elect Trump and the media. There was a frank and candid, we are told, off-the-record conversation yesterday between television news channels and Mr. Trump. Today, an on-the-record conversation at the New York Times. And last night, in between, a YouTube video in which Mr. Trump reaffirmed his promise to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big trade deal the Obama administration's been working on. Harkening back to our coverage immediately after the election, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now on what happens next with the TPP and trade.
In a 2.5-minute scripted video, President-elect Trump called the Trans-Pacific Partnership a potential disaster for our country.
Instead, we will negotiate fair bilateral trade deals that bring jobs and industry back onto American shores.
That won't be easy. The TPP between the U.S., Australia, Japan, and 9 other countries took the better part of a decade to negotiate. Nate Olson with the Stimson Center, a nonpartisan think tank, says sheer force of personality won't bend those countries to U.S. desires.
Unfortunately, global trade cannot be handled one boardroom showdown at a time.
Meanwhile, China has been working on its own trade pact with many of the same partners. Finance professor Jeffrey Bergstrand at Notre Dame says that deal lacks many of the intellectual property and workers' rights in the TPP.
And in the absence of TPP, that will become a major agreement that will dominate and set the rules for international trade in the Asian Pacific Rim and leave the United States out of that.
That will make it harder for U.S. businesses to compete, he says. But Dean Baker with the Center for Economic and Policy Research says trade will not grind to a halt. The U.S. already has trade agreements with 6 of the 11 countries.
We're going to still trade with Mexico and Canada just as we did before with Australia. And we have massive trade with Japan. I mean, that's not going to stop.
What's not clear, he says, is just how Trump plans to bring back American jobs in new trade deals. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Down 19,000 for those keeping track. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We had University of Michigan economist Justin Wolfers on the program a couple of weeks before the election, talking about a paper he had written saying that the markets were betting and betting big on a Clinton win. As we know, things didn't turn out that way. And last week, Justin wrote up his early thoughts on what might have happened with his prediction, betting markets wise. So we called him up to talk it over. Justin, good to have you back.
A pleasure to be back, Kai.
In your piece in the Times last week, laying out what had happened, you basically said the headline is "Markets sent a strong signal on Trump, then changed their minds." My question to you is, what happened, man? Because you were so sure when we talked.
It was a night and two acts, Kai. It was absolutely clear by midnight that Trump was going to win the election, and you saw markets cratering. But then after midnight, just something changed, and markets rallied, and by the end of the week, they were back up where they'd been before the election, and in fact, a little bit above.
You lay out a couple of possibilities in this piece from last week. The first is, and this is your theory, a failure of imagination. Investors, you write, simply failed to imagine how they might feel when they woke up to President-elect Trump.
Part of this comes from introspection. I will admit I woke up on Wednesday morning after the election and saw the sun was still shining.
There's another thing you postulate here, this thing that psychologists and some behavioral economists call focusing illusion, that thing that's right in front of you that's the most important thing in the world.
Yeah, if I ask you about something, what you immediately do is you focus on the thing that's most different between the two. So how do you apply that to the election? Traders were trying to think about the difference between Trumpland and Clintonia, and they immediately started thinking about the stark differences. And maybe what happened on Wednesday morning is we woke up and realized that much of what goes on in our lives or in our investing lives is not about what's happening in Washington.
You quote a, just on that, what's happening in Washington thing, you quote an analyst note that said maybe investors switched from focusing on the man to the man's policies, which, as you and I discussed last time, are generally more business friendly, quite possibly good for companies and thus good for the markets.
Trump's policies are like catnip for investors. Huge corporate tax cuts and deregulation of the financial sector. I'm not saying either of those would be good for the economy, but they'd be good for stocks. I'll tell you an interesting thing. I looked at data on Google searches for the words Trump tax plan. And it turns out in the 3 months leading up to the election, basically no one on earth Googled that. The next morning, searches for Trump's tax plan went through the roof.
You are and have been a vocal proponent of betting markets and how these markets where people are putting money on the line can tell you what's going to happen. Clearly, something went haywire here. We don't have a method for predicting how good the markets are or not. What does this say about your favorite tool here, or one of your favorite tools anyway?
Well, in fact, the markets were saying it was about as likely that he'd win the presidency as the Cubs would win the World Series.
Yeah.
The Cubs won the World Series, and sports betting fans said that something somewhat unusual had happened. Unusual, but not unheard of. And I think that's what happened this time. The markets did get it wrong, but we shouldn't be surprised when that happens.
You got to be surprised when that happens. Come on, right?
You're exactly right, Kai. I should be surprised when the Cubs win the World Series, and I should be surprised when the underdog wins the presidency. But in neither case should it cause sort of a fundamental re-examination. I mean, some of the commentary I've heard has been, you know, we should no longer listen to markets, we should no longer listen to polls, we should no longer listen to any quantitative analysis at all. And I think that's tremendously overblown.
Justin Wolfers is a professor of economics at the University of Michigan. Justin, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
The fight over health care in Washington isn't limited to Obamacare. All the while that the headline conversation has been about repeal and replace, there has been a sidebar of sorts happening about drug prices. Americans spent more than $400 billion on prescription drugs last year, drugs that can save lives, yes, but are increasingly hard for people to afford. From our health desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more on that story.
Here's a friendly heads up. If you watch a lot of TV in the next few months, you'll probably hear something like this.
Before it became a medicine, it was an idea.
This is a commercial produced by drug giant Pfizer. As you can hear, the spot makes the case that earnest scientists pour their hearts into challenging, expensive, rewarding work.
36 clinical trials, 8,500 patient volunteers, and the hope of millions.
This 60-second commercial is basically the industry's way of responding to the steady drip-drip of 2 years' worth of terrible press, often focused on companies who've jacked up prices. There was the generic drug used by HIV/AIDS patients that went from $13.50 to $750 per pill. Then there was the 400% increase on EpiPens. Stories like these have galvanized critics who want more than congressional hearings. The industry knows it's under attack. Robert Zirkelbach is a pharma spokesperson.
We want to make sure that we're able to avoid advancing harmful policies based on the isolated examples in the headlines. There's a lot at stake.
Which is why the industry's gearing up. This summer, the trade group hiked membership fees 50%, which is expected to raise an additional $100 million. They're planning an advertising blitz, and it looks like they're swelling their ranks, says Sheila Krumholz, who heads the Center for Responsive Politics.
Pharma, the major trade group representing the pharmaceutical industry, did hire Akin Gump, which is a powerhouse lobbying firm, just a few weeks ago, and Advanced Policy Consulting just a month ago.
As the industry adds to its army of lobbyists for this effort, advocates for more regulation are marshaling their resources. Without drug makers' deep pockets, people pushing for cheaper drugs are likely to wage a hearts and minds campaign. They'll certainly look to leverage public sentiment. This fall, a Kaiser Family Foundation survey found 3/4 of Americans believe the federal government should do something about high-cost drugs. So those who want to fight pharma are counting on stories from people like Kathleen Werling.
You can only shell out $8,000 in cash for so many months.
In a way, Werling is the other side's PR campaign. The 48-year-old from outside Cleveland did everything she had to do to get the medicine she needed for her malignant melanoma.
We drained our 401k. We drained our children's college education funds, 6 of them. We started getting to the point of, do we pay for this drug or do we pay our mortgage on our house?
Werling and her husband chose the drug. They lost the house. This upcoming battle could easily devolve into Kathleen's story versus pharma's position that limiting profits means pumping out fewer life-saving drugs. So that's where we are. Both sides lining up. President-elect Trump, during his campaign, talked about importing drugs and letting Medicare negotiate prices. But of course, both sides are waiting to see what he may do. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, I'm an associate, and no job is too small, no job is too large.
A CEO on the sales floor straight ahead, but first, sure, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 67 points today, 0.3%, 19,023. The NASDAQ up 17 points, 0.3%, 5386. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%. Finishing at 2202. If you hire a moving company, it's going to be privately owned. United Van Lines, Allied Van Lines, Mayflower, and of course, starving students. You move yourself with a U-Haul, you're doing business with Amerco. Amerco off 0.7% today. Homebuyers hate buying title insurance. The biggest title company is First American. First American Financial Corp up 1.5% today. Old Republic National Title Insurance is another one. Old Republic International up 1%. I hear wallpaper is back. That's actually true. I heard that in a conversation the other day. Here is an oldie but a goodie. Marimekko, I don't know, off 0.3% in Helsinki. Bond prices unchanged. 10-year T-note stayed at 2.31%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker, do you think that this technology has saved you?
I'm probably alive because of it, but I don't know. I think it's probably saved me physically, but I think spiritually it probably bankrupted me.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Once you're as big as Amazon, selling all the stuff that Amazon sells, where else is there to go? Well, according to the Wall Street Journal, live sports is where. Amazon is said to be in talks with the NFL, the NBA, and others for the rights to stream live games. The point of order here is the distinction between streaming and plain old broadcasting, as Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports.
Maybe you stream Game of Thrones or Black Mirror, but live sports, chances are if you watch them, it's on TV. So no wonder Amazon wants to enter this business, says Adam Grossman, CEO and founder of Block 6 Analytics.
It's a clear revenue driver and a clear revenue play.
He says people love their sports. According to Nielsen ratings, more than 90% of the top live TV people watched last year were sports. So, of course, the conventional players are watching Amazon.
There's a threat here. There's a threat that people will stop watching on conventional TVs.
Stefan Szymański is a professor of sports management at the University of Michigan. He says if Amazon can strike a deal with, say, the NFL or NBA to carry live games,
they can drive subscription values, but also they can drive you to other related services.
Like to branded sports equipment or T-shirts. Grossman says Amazon may also explore international rights deals.
And not just in like soccer, but they've been looking at rugby and cricket.
Amazon, he says, may try to build its audience with more low-profile sports first. Also, traditional media already have a lock on the major sports, says entertainment lawyer Anthony Caruso.
That's going to be the legal issue, one of the legal issues that will be in control of whether this happens quickly or not.
He says there are still a lot of questions that need to be answered before Amazon can join the big leagues of televised sports. Other tech giants are trying to enter this space. Twitter already partnered with the NFL to stream 10 games. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Thanksgiving's in a couple of days, which means Black Friday's in a couple of days, which explains why I was in Dallas yesterday taping an interview for a new installment of Conversations from the Corner Office. The CEO of JCPenney, his name is Marvin Ellison.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
You might not be as familiar with JCPenney's still-in-progress turnaround as you were with the implosion it suffered under former CEO Ron Johnson. Johnson, of course, is the guy who helped Steve Jobs design the Apple Store, and he was kind of supposed to do the same thing for Penny. Did not work out so well. Profits cratered, stores were closed, people were laid off, and it is now Marvin Ellison's job to fix it. So as we stood yesterday morning amid women's workout gear in the JCPenney store at the Stonebriar Mall in Frisco, Texas, just north of Dallas, I asked Marvin Ellison what the biggest difference is at Penny with him as CEO.
Well, you know, I think a couple of things. Number one, you have to know who you are and what you stand for as a business. That sounds so very simple, but I think there's a lot of confusion around what is JCPenney as a brand and what consumer are we trying to serve? And so I think there's a lot more clarity today than, you know, 2+ years ago.
Explain that a little bit. I mean, who is your consumer and what are you trying to do now?
Well, I think one of the big mistakes we've made in the past is that we had a core consumer, very traditional, you know, what I call middle America consumer, and we want to move away from that. We want to go to more progressive kind of millennial type of consumer, and so we changed our brands, we changed the fit and fabric, we tried to make the store a little bit hipper to attract a more younger kind of more millennial type customer, and it fell pretty miserably. And when you look at the data is pretty compelling. Over 70% of our customers are female, which was not a big surprise.
Yeah.
But when you take that female percent, 55% is on average about 60 years old.
Half your customers are women more than 60 years old?
Yeah. You know, 60 years old, kids moved out of the house, homeowner, enjoys traditional types of media. But then the other 45% is in her early 30s. She's very multicultural. She has, on average, 2 children, and she lives her life through social media. Mm-hmm. And so we have these 2 very different customers, yet we were trying to serve, you know, a customer that didn't was not really interested in shopping with us. And so now we have a strategy where we're leveraging our marketing, our media, to communicate to 2 different customers, but they have some common fundamental things that they both want.
All right, so let's walk a little bit, and
sure.
I want you to tell me what you're seeing as we go by, since this is your store and
yeah.
You're running a place. So we're heading through like jewelry and accessories.
Yeah, right? Well, one of the things that we've done here is that we have this wonderful Sephora partnership,
yep.
And it's our fastest
it's
growing
makeup
business.
And skincare. And
it
all.
Is. It's a fabulous business. The problem is that the surrounding areas, you know, adjacent to Sephora did not connect with that same younger, more millennial customer. This is for that emerging, you know, multicultural younger female right. consumer. And this area was not conducive. So we reset this entire, we call it center core. So mm-hmm. it's the center of the store, and we reset it so it can have a more aesthetic feel that Sephora doesn't feel like an oasis in the middle of a desert.
So when you sit in the front office and you issue this directive that says basically fix this, how closely entwined are you with the decision to move women's workout gear closer to Sephora?
Well, it's a great question. So it really comes down to getting the consumer feedback and understanding consumer trends, when the trends were pretty clear that
this is data,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, data that the active wear was really growing fast and that the consumer was becoming more casual. When we just took a quick view of our store, I mean, we were not set that way. So the question was, how do we set our store to be more in line with consumer trends? And so we took about 10 or 15 stores, and we decided to just kind of reset this area and moving apparel in a way where active was closer to the front, and we measured the results. And when the results came in positive, then we started to make the shift for the whole company. So it's a test and learn environment.
You're doing better sales and revenue-wise than you have in the past number of years, but you're still not making money, right? So look at that. All right, so now you're picking up. What is yeah. That's like reindeer.
This is this is
you got to police the store, right?
Well, I'm an associate, and and no job is too small, no yeah. job is too large. Well, we are, but here's the challenge. The challenge is the reason we're not making money is because of the debt burden. So when Mike Allman came back after Ron Johnson left the company, Mike was the previous CEO. He had to create enough liquidity that the company could operate effectively.
Right.
So we had to take on a significant amount of debt. And so when I arrived, we had an interest payment north of $400 million a year. And so if you think about that, that's an extra expense that the 2 years prior did not exist. And so that is the burden that we're getting over. Here's the good news. The good news is when we hit our forecast for the fourth quarter, we'll end the year at profitable earnings. That'll be the first time since, I think, 2010.
This is your second Black Friday, right, as CEO?
Yes, sir.
What'd you learn the first time through that you're doing different this time?
What we learned is we believe that it was important to have a more simple message. So you're going to see us talk a lot about gifts under $20, gifts under $15. So simplify the message to the consumer. We also learned that we, you know, probably needed to have more giftable items that a customer could easily pick up and turn it into a gift for a family member or for a loved one. And we decided that we wanted to get into a category that was bigger ticket, so we rolled out appliance showrooms to over 500 stores.
I was going to ask you about appliances, because are you becoming Sears here? Is that what's going on? What data point do you have that says we need to have side-by-side refrigerators and ranges on our second floor here?
It's a couple interesting data points. So in America, 100,000...
Well, there are data points. Look at this.
Absolutely. Yeah. In America, 100,000 appliances break every day. Every day.
No, really?
Every day. Think about it. Every home
has... It feels
like
they're all in my house, but that's a whole different thing.
Every home, I feel the same way. Every home has a dishwasher, refrigerator, washer, dryer, you know, microwave, oven, range. And so the data shows that the appliance category, because of innovation, new home building, and home turnover, is going to grow over the next 3 years. And when we ran the data, and this is called a failed search analysis. So we went to jcpenney.com, and we looked at all the searches that customers put in for items that we didn't carry, and at the top of the list was major appliances.
Wow.
So customers were coming to jcpenney.com searching for appliances, and we didn't have it. And then we asked our customers, you know, would you buy appliances from us? And they said yes, if the brands were appropriate, if the prices were right, and if there was a service guarantee on quality. And so we think we've addressed all those things, and it's been a significant success for us.
Marvin, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Didn't go all the way to Texas for 6.5 minutes of radio. You can hear the rest of my chat with Marvin Ellison about how his first job in retail was as a security guard. Also, how the company is thinking about doing business under a Trump administration. It's all on our Corner Office podcast. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. The This final note on the way out today, a quick addition to Sabree's reporting on the emoluments clause that we started with. Mr. Trump, as I mentioned, did a long interview with the New York Times today. Wide-reaching, I think, is probably the appropriate phrase. He was asked, among other things, about conflicts of interest between his official duties and his business dealings. His response went like this, quote, "The law is totally on my side. The president can't have a conflict of interest," end of quote. That may at first blush remind some of you of this, Richard Nixon to David Frost in 1977.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Fact of the matter is, though, that with conflicts of interest, Mr. Trump has it legally right in this case. All right, we are out of here. The Dow up 67 points today, 0.3% above 19,000 for the first time ever. The NASDAQ up 17 points, 0.3%. S&P 500 up 0.4%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.